So, time to start a new unit. Try to keep this in your brain while you study for the test, because you'll still be tested over this eventually. This is the first chapter of the rest of the term. I say that because we're entering the nervous system, and we'll be in the nervous system for the rest of the course, in one way or another. In this chapter, we're going to be investigating the nervous system at the histological level. So this is the nervous tissue chapter. And what we're looking at in slide one is a schematic representation of the two primary subdivisions of the overall nervous system. So the nervous system is the complete organ system. But that has two primary subdivisions, the central nervous system and the peripheral nervous system. Now those are not complete organ systems, they're just subdivisions of the overall nervous system. And the central nervous system, as you see, is made up of the brain and the spinal cord. That's it. Those two combined make up what we call the central nervous system. The rest of the organ system is collectively the peripheral nervous system. So called because periphery means edge. So the peripheral nervous system is all the stuff on the edge, the stuff that connects to the central nervous system but is not part of it, is the peripheral nervous system. Now, before I forget, while we're on this slide, even though they're not really labeled here, I want to give you four definitions, especially because you might misuse these words otherwise. The four words are nucleus, tract, nerve, and ganglion. All right? Each of these is a collection of parts of cells, but they have distinct meanings. So you misuse them if you don't adhere to these definitions I'm going to give you. First of all, you have to realize what the basic anatomy of a neuron is, or recall that, because we kind of talked about this before, and we'll go over it again in the next slide. But a neuron, remember, is an entire cell. And a neuron has a soma, S-O-M-A, or a cell body, as it's also called. And then most neurons will have a long axon extending therefrom. Just like motor neurons that we've already discussed in the previous chapter. Okay, so just keep that basic two-part structural idea in mind. All right, now to these four definitions. A nerve, and this is the one that gets misused because nerve is a word that gets used colloquially, just people in the streets using the word nerve. But there's a technical meaning to nerve in anatomy. A nerve is a bundle of axons, and so it's multiple axons, but just the axons, not the cell bodies. A bundle of axons from different neurons, all running in parallel, like strands of a cable. That's not the end of the definition, though. A nerve specifically is a bundle of axons occurring in the peripheral nervous system, which means that technically there are no nerves in the central nervous system, because nerves are only in the peripheral nervous system. All right. Now, there are correspondingly bundles of axons in the central nervous system, but those are not properly called nerves. A bundle of axons in the central nervous system, either brain or spinal cord, is called a tract, T-R-A-C-T. Now, the other two correspond to each other just like tract and nerve correspond to each other, except they are bundles of cell bodies or groups of cell bodies. A nucleus is a group of neuronal cell bodies occurring in the central nervous system. And notice that that is an entirely different use of the word nucleus from what we've been using up to this point. Really, three uses that we use in this class: an atomic nucleus, a cell nucleus, and a nucleus of the nervous system. Those are totally different levels of size. The corresponding word is ganglion, and a ganglion is a bundle or a group of cell bodies, neuronal cell bodies, in the peripheral nervous system. Okay? So, the peripheral nervous system is made up of nerves and ganglia. Some other things thrown in as well, but we don't find nerves and ganglia in the central nervous system. Instead, correspondingly, we find tracts and nuclei. Now, all four of those terms apply only to neurons or parts of neurons, right? But as you should already know, neurons are not the only kind of cells found in the nervous system. What is the other type of cell? Collectively, we call them neuroglia, right, or glial cells, of which there are several different kinds, but collectively they're all called neuroglia. And the reason it makes sense to just group them into two categories, neurons and everything else, which are neuroglia, is because of a fundamental difference between neurons and neuroglia. What is that fundamental difference? Functionally speaking. Right, the ability or inability to produce an action potential. What do we call such an ability? Excitability. Neurons are the excitable cells of the nervous system. Neuroglia do not create action potentials. Neuroglia are there as support cells. They, in one way or another, support the neurons. And by the way, they vastly outnumber neurons. There are at least 10 neuroglia for every neuron in your nervous system. And there's about a trillion neurons in your nervous system, so there's a lot of neuroglia. But your neurons are the ones that fire, as we say, meaning create action potentials and propagate them along their axons. All right, let's go to two and subdivide the nervous system even further. So there's two primary subdivisions, central nervous system, peripheral nervous system. But as we see here, each of these can itself be subdivided. So the central nervous system in blue, we've already talked about. Its subdivisions are really just anatomical. Brain and spinal cord are the two anatomical subdivisions of the central nervous system. The peripheral nervous system has subdivisions that are functional. So it's not really that you'll find them in different places. The subdivisions are all in one place, but they operate differently. So the divisions of the peripheral nervous system are the major subdivisions, or the motor and sensory divisions. Sensory information is incoming information from the viewpoint of the central nervous system. Sensory information comes into or gets delivered to the central nervous system for processing. And there's a corresponding word that we use for sensory information or incoming information, and that is afferent. A-F-F-E-R-E-N-T. That's in opposition to the word efferent, which is the same word only starting with an E. So don't confuse those two words. They're antagonists. Or they're antonyms, I should say. Afferent means incoming. Efferent means outgoing. Sensory information is afferent because it's being delivered to the central nervous system. Efferent information comes from the central nervous system and is moving outwardly. So the motor division can be called the efferent division. The sensory division can be called the afferent division. By the way, this is analogous to two words that you doubtless already know, which are affect and effect, right? Maybe I shouldn't even mention that because it can actually confuse you even more. But afferent is incoming, efferent is outgoing. And while I'm at it, let me say that sense and sensation are not the same thing. Sense refers simply to afferent information. Sensation, on the other hand, refers to high-level processing that occurs in the brain and creates an experience for you. For instance, vision is sensation. That vision, that sensation, doesn't occur until you first have incoming sensory information. All right? Unless it's artificially created, like in a dream. Or if you press your eye, that's not really light coming into your eye, but you'll see light. That's the sensation. You have all kinds of sensory information going into your central nervous system all the time that you have no idea about consciously. For instance, you don't have a sensation of your blood pressure, but your brain is always keeping track of that because you have baroreceptors in your body continuously monitoring that blood pressure. Similarly for other variables like pH, for instance. So all of that, it's incoming information, so it's sensory information, but not all sensory information leads to sensation. Okay, the motor division is so named because usually something moves in response to that outgoing information or efferent information. For instance, all the skeletal muscles, which are innervated by motor neurons of the motor division of the nervous system, move in response to action potentials. That's what we've been talking about in the last chapter. But there are also motor neurons that innervate other things besides skeletal muscles. Namely, the other kinds of muscles, cardiac muscle and smooth muscle throughout the body. Well, cardiac muscle is not throughout the body, but smooth muscle is. And even things that aren't muscle, chiefly glands. So glands and muscles combined, no matter what kind of muscle you're talking about, muscles and glands, which are the end recipients of this information, this efferent information, these are collectively called effector organs. Okay? Effector organs receive efferent information and respond by moving. Even in the case of glands, really there's movement because it causes secretion of whatever secretory product that gland happens to produce. It secretes it in response to the efferent information. So, those are the two major subdivisions of just the peripheral nervous system, and each of those divisions, as you see, can be further subdivided. Sensory division has a visceral and a somatic division within it. Visceral means of the viscera. Viscera is the plural of viscous. V-I-C, V-I-S-C-U-S, not V-I-S-C-O-U-S. With an O-U-S ending, viscous means thick, like maple syrup. It doesn't flow very easily. Viscous, just U-S, refers to an internal organ. The things we call the guts, those are the viscera. You know, there's a lot of viscera in the abdominal pelvic cavity, for instance, intestines and whatnot. Somatic means of the body. Soma means body. That's why the cell body of a neuron is called the soma, or some books will call it the neurosoma. That's kind of a misnomer because the viscera are, of course, part of your body as well. But somatic, really, in terms of the division of the sensory division, refers to muscles. Okay, so your muscles are continuously sending, well, neurons that are connected to the muscles, I should say, are continuously sending sensory information to the brain and spinal cord through that somatic sensory division. You have to have feedback from the muscles in order to properly control them. You don't just have output to the muscles. You need your brain has to continuously make calculations about whether the amount of effort you're putting in is appropriate for what you're trying to do. Right? If you try to contract too much or too little, just in a postural sense, you know, if just me standing here, if I don't use just the right amount of contraction, I'll just fall over. The reason I don't fall over is because I'm continuously making a calculation based on that incoming information and comparing it to what I want to do and making adjustments in the motor division by changing the amount of contraction so that I don't fall over. All right, so there's sensory information coming in from the muscles through the somatic sensory division and from the internal organs through the visceral division. Well, there are corresponding divisions of the motor division, visceral and somatic. So there's output efferent information being sent to the viscera. And this is how, for instance, glands get stimulated. But also smooth muscle and cardiac muscle. Your heart rate gets adjusted continuously by motor output through the visceral division, visceral motor division of the motor division. And so do your smooth muscles. So the rate of digestion, the rate of peristalsis in the alimentary canal, that's all part of that motor activity as well. The somatic motor division includes just the information going to the skeletal muscles. All right? So that's the stuff that is consciously controlled almost entirely. I shouldn't say that it's entirely conscious. You do have conscious control of your skeletal muscles, of course. But when it comes to reflexes, like when you have the little hammer on your knee as a reflex test, you're not deciding to twitch that muscle. That's a reflex. Still involves motor neurons, but not consciously controlled in that case. But the somatic motor division serves or innervates only skeletal muscles. Then finally, the visceral motor division itself is even further subdivided into the parasympathetic and the sympathetic divisions. Okay, so the sympathetic and the parasympathetic division, in a sense, are opposites of each other. They work antagonistically for the most part. The sympathetic division, when it sends output, will ready the body for physical activity. It will increase activity of heart and lungs, you know, your breathing, it gets ramped up in preparation for physical activity. And at the same time, that output from the sympathetic division will turn down digestion, for instance. If you're running away from the tiger that's about to eat you, it's more important that you get going quickly, send blood to your skeletal muscles so that they can work well so you can run away, than it is to digest the last meal you had. That can wait. Parasympathetic division, on the other hand, turns down those things that are associated with physical activity and turns up digestion. So they work in opposite ways. I should have mentioned also that these two divisions, which are make up collectively the visceral motor division, that visceral motor division can also be called the autonomic nervous system, or ANS. Okay? Autonomic is just the adjective of autonomy. Autonomy means self-control. So the autonomic nervous system, or visceral motor division, works behind the scenes. You don't have to remember to beat your heart. You don't have to remember to breathe. You don't have to consciously adjust the diameter of your blood vessels. That's all part of the autonomic nervous system working behind the scenes. All right, now to three. This little diagram shows you in very simple form what the overall function of the nervous system is. Overall, the nervous system operates by receiving incoming information, which is sensory or afferent information. It processes that information somehow, and that processing of information in the central nervous system is called integration. And then after that integration, some output is sent as efferent information to some effector organ to either contract some sort of muscle or to have some gland secrete, or to not have these things happen as well, which is also output. So that's what the overall nervous system does. And anatomically, that means information needs to be sent to the central nervous system through sensory neurons, which are located partially in the peripheral nervous system. That's where the nerve endings are. But these neurons are long, and they extend from wherever they are in the body to the central nervous system, either into the spinal cord or the brain. Those are sensory neurons. And by the way, you have a schematic representation of neurons that is kind of a standard way of picturing these. Usually you don't even bother showing the little nerve endings here. It would just be a cell body, which is a circle with a line, and then ending in a half circle, which this one uses like a V shape. A lot of other books will use a half circle at the end. The half circle represents the axon terminal of that neuron. The circle represents the soma, or the cell body. And the line, the length of that line, represents the axon. Okay, so you can tell the directionality that schematically represented neuron has by where that terminal is. And by the way, speaking of directionality, that's an important point about neurons. Functionally speaking, they are directional. The action potentials that they create get propagated down their length, but that's always in one direction. Action potentials get propagated from where the cell body is down the axon toward the axon terminal, or terminals. Okay, so there's directionality to the flow of information. Now, if you artificially create an action potential at the other end of a neuron, it will travel backwards. But we'll examine later why that actually doesn't happen in normal life. That has to be an artificial situation. All right, so the sensory neuron is shown in one, and the left half of this represents the peripheral nervous system. The right half, in different shading, represents the central nervous system. Notice the sensory neuron extends into the central nervous system somewhere. And then it synapses with, creates a synapse with, a second neuron, which is the short one shown by the number 2 here. And notice that this kind of neuron is entirely within the central nervous system. Cell body, axon, the entire neuron is in the central nervous system. That's called an interneuron. It's one name for it. Or an association neuron. And these association neurons, or interneurons, are really what perform the integration, the processing of that incoming information. Now, there doesn't have to be just one interneuron involved. And in fact, in the simplest possible reflex, there isn't even an interneuron. But usually there is some number of interneurons involved in the central nervous system. And in terms of just the neurons, ignoring the neuroglia, if you count just the neurons, most of the neurons of your nervous system are interneurons. There's a hell of a lot of these short interneurons in the brain and spinal cord. So they will then synapse with a third neuron in series, which is the motor neuron. And that motor neuron starts out in the central nervous system, but then its axon extends out into the peripheral nervous system and goes somewhere in the body to some sort of effector, either a muscle or a gland. Which is, in this case, it's shown as a skeletal muscle, so that's why this would be part of the somatic motor nervous system that this neuron is part of. Okay? But in any case, it's motor information going out. Now we can look in slide 4 at a little bit more detail of the anatomy of an individual neuron. And not all neurons look like this, as we'll discuss in a little bit, but this is kind of an idealized picture of a neuron. One thing that is true of all neurons, though, well, I shouldn't say all. Any neuron that has an axon, which is almost all neurons, has exactly one axon. So there aren't neurons with multiple axons. There are a few that don't have any axon, but the vast majority of axons have a single axon. And usually those axons are pretty long compared to other things that connect with the cell body. Cell body is the enlargement, and that's where you find the nucleus. And you also have associated other organelles. Endoplasmic reticulum, ribosomes, so on. The things that you find in normal cells, and those things are doing the same sorts of things they do in other cells. The nucleus is there to house the DNA, which includes the genes that can be transcribed into messenger RNA that then gets transported out of the nucleus and is used by ribosomes to produce proteins. That's what happens in general in all cells. That's happening, though, in the cell body. And that's why it's bigger. So it's easy to spot the cell body, but notice that the cell body has some number of projections or protrusions from its surface. One of those is the axon, the single axon. But there can be some other number of other projections, and those are called dendrites. Now, I try to say this in a way that I don't call dendrites branches. I mean, structurally they are branches, but in terms of the flow of information, I don't want you to consider them to be branches. I want you to consider them to be tributaries. You see what the difference between those words? For instance, rivers in general don't branch. Rivers don't branch into smaller waterways. Instead, smaller waterways that are flowing this way come together. They converge into bigger and bigger rivers until you're finally at the Mississippi, which drains into the ocean. So those are called tributaries. They contribute to the downstream bigger flow. And that's what dendrites, that's how I want you to think about dendrites in terms of flow of information. Because dendrites, however many there are on a neuron, are receivers of information. So there are connections made between something upstream of the neuron and dendrites of that neuron. Now, what that thing is that's upstream of the neuron depends on the situation. It could be some other upstream neuron, because neurons synapse with other neurons. Or it could be some sort of sensory organ that is sending information to these dendrites. But whatever the source is, the information that is being sent to dendrites is going to be encoded as changes in membrane potential. So the membrane potential, remember, is a voltage. A voltage is a gradient, and so in this case it's a gradient of electrical charge. There's going to be a charge difference from one side of the membrane to the other, so through the membrane. And that's true of the overall membrane for the whole cell, but the value of that voltage can be different at different parts of the cell. And so when something, in a sense, knocks on the door of a dendrite, trying to give it information, that's going to change the voltage in that little slice of membrane that makes up that dendrite. Okay? So they are the receivers. But on the other side of that cell body is one axon. And that axon is usually much, much longer than the dendrites are. This is what makes it's the axon that makes some neurons extraordinarily long for single cells. They can be a meter long in a human because there's a single neuron going all the way from the toe to the spinal cord. That's one cell, and it's very, very thin. This is why it can be so long, by the way. This is why it doesn't violate the constraint of surface area to volume ratio, right? It doesn't get long. It doesn't get big in all three dimensions. It would be impossible to be that big and be a single cell. But if you're long and thin in the other two dimensions, you still have a high surface area to volume ratio and can exist as a single cell. What were you going to say? The axon starts at that trigger zone, which is labeled above axon, and it's everything else below that, even the branches. But it's still considered one axon because there's one connection point with the cell body. And so not all axons branch, but many do. And those branches are called axon collaterals. But those collaterals directly connect to the axon. They don't directly connect to the cell body. Otherwise, they would be separate axons, and that would violate what I just told you is true. A neuron has at most one axon. And the reason this is significant in terms of function is that if an action potential gets created in an axon, and that happens at this trigger zone that's labeled there, right, where it joins the cell body, if that happens, then the action potential is going to travel or get propagated undiminished, so it's going to keep its intensity, for the entire axon, including however many collaterals there are. This is why I was saying in the previous chapter that you can't have an axon fire just some of its branches and not others. If the axon fires, all of the collaterals fire with it, because they're all part of it. And therefore, wherever those collaterals go, which might be to different effectors, all of those effectors are going to receive the same input in terms of an action potential.
Okay, now, this particular axon, and not all of them are like this, happens to be an example of a myelinated axon.
Myelin, M-Y-E-L-I-N, is a way to electrically insulate an axon. But the myelin is not part of the neuron. The neuron in this cartoon is all the brown. Notice that the little myelin sheaths, which are these little things right here, there's many of them. Each one of them is slightly blue. Each myelin sheath is a neuroglial cell. It's not a neuron. So you have one enormous axon and then many neuroglia that make up these myelin sheaths. And it's only axons that are myelinated, if at all. Some neurons have unmyelinated axons, and we'll talk more about this later. Some axons have myelinated axons. I mean, some neurons have myelinated axons. Okay? But the myelin sheaths are not actually a structural feature of the neuron itself. They are neuroglia. At the very end, you have, of course, axon terminals, self-descriptive. The number of axon terminals depends on how many collaterals you have and also how many branches you have at the very end. These branches at the very end are usually not called collaterals. Collaterals are major branches farther upstream. So even one that you wouldn't say has any collaterals would still branch at the very end and have a lot of finger-like branches. And at each one of those tips, you find a synaptic knob, just like we already described in the case of the neuromuscular junction. So this is just generally true of all neurons, not just somatic motor neurons. All right, so notice that the trigger zone includes something that's called the axon hillock and something that's called the initial segment. The axon hillock is just that delta-shaped or V-shaped, triangular-shaped zone where the axon actually connects directly to the cell body. So there's no distinct line saying this is the boundary between cell body and axon hillock, but it's that region. The trigger zone, which is right immediately distal in terms of the flow of information, immediately distal to the axon hillock, that's also not delineated from the hillock itself. It's more of a functional definition. It's called the trigger zone because in the cell membrane of that trigger zone are voltage-gated sodium channels that will create an action potential if the proper threshold voltage is attained. So what happens in general in a neuron is that all of these inputs coming in through dendrites will cause what are called local or graded potential changes in voltage at the cell body, that will get integrated. They'll get summed together. And if that sum brings the trigger zone up to threshold voltage, then you'll get an action potential. If not, you won't. All right? So that is itself an integrating process. You're integrating several inputs through dendrites in order to determine whether there is or is not going to be an output. That's processing of information. That's how the nervous system works in general. Okay, let's go on and look at other kinds of neurons in terms of shape in slide 5. So there's these four major categories, as you see here in the shaded boxes. At the top, we have multipolar neurons. Now, I just told you that a neuron has at most one axon. Poles refer to connection points with the cell body. So an axon represents a pole. A multipolar neuron is one that has a single axon and multiple dendrites, as you see in the picture there.
and how those dendrites appear. Notice, by the way, that it's the one on the left, on the upper box, is even though the only one of those two dendrites is labeled, the other dendrite is the thing that hangs off to the lower left. Both of those things have connection points directly with the cell body, right? So they're dendrites. There's one axon, though, coming off. You see what I'm saying? That's two dendrites, one axon. And the other one has the connection points directly with the cell body are coming together right at the cell body, but there are still multiple connection points. So multiple dendrites, one axon, that's a multipolar neuron. In the next one below it, you have a bipolar neuron, which is two poles, two connection points directly with the cell body, one of which is the axon. So a bipolar neuron has one axon, one dendrite. It doesn't mean that the dendrite doesn't have multiple inputs, because of its branched nature, it's still considered one dendrite because it has one direct connection with the cell body, as in the picture. And then you have unipolar neurons in some cases. A unipolar neuron has, by definition, only one direct connection with the cell body. And what's happening here is that the dendrites, which is properly used just to describe these very ends on the left, become immediately the axon without the cell body in between. Then the axon travels some distance and has somewhere along that length a connection with the cell body. So it's unipolar, even though it does have a dendrite and an axon, they're not both connected directly to the cell body. And then the most unusual and the scarcest in your body of the types is shown on the bottom, and an axonic neuron. Axonic means having an axon, so anaxonic means not having an axon. This thing has dendrites, some number of dendrites, and a cell body, but no axon. And these things are not only anatomically unusual in not having an axon, but they're physiologically unusual for a neuron because they do not produce action potentials. They operate on graded potentials happening at dendrites, and they release neurotransmitters like ordinary neurons do. Just they don't produce an action potential and send it down an axon in doing so. You find some of these in the retina, for instance, of your eyes. Okay, now to six. Actually, I'm going to leave the reading of six to you since it's a table, and I'll just go to the one that shows the picture. What we're looking at in slide 7 are different types of neuroglia. Now, neuroglia is the general word that means all of the cells in the nervous system other than the neurons. And remember, these are cells that do not produce action potentials, but they're differentiated from each other because they have different roles to play, they have different functions in the nervous system, and they also have different locations in which they're found. All right, so some of these are found only in the central nervous system, some of these are found only in the peripheral nervous system. Let's just work in the order they're listed here in the pictures. Astrocytes are found only in the peripheral nervous system. And astrocytes get their name because they have a bunch of cell projections that make them look like a star. Astrocytes astrocytes, as you can see, have little perivascular feet that connect to capillaries. And one of the things that these astrocytes do is stimulate the capillaries into forming what's called the blood-brain barrier. Ependymal cells in yellow, which are these big ones, these might look very epithelial to you, they're not actually technically epithelial cells because they don't have a true basal lamina like true epithelia do. These ependymal cells, though, are found lining the cavities that you find in the central nervous system. The central nervous system, remember, is brain and spinal cord. But when you later we'll look more at the anatomy of the brain and spinal cord, and both of these two structures have spaces inside them. Cavities in the brain that are called ventricles, and there's also a cavity down most of the length of the spinal cord where you don't find cells. It's a fluid-filled space, or they are all fluid-filled spaces. And the fluid that fills those spaces is called cerebrospinal fluid. And it's important stuff to have. It saves your life probably every day because it absorbs shock. When you move your head around or if you get banged on the head, cerebrospinal fluid will cushion a lot of that force. So concussions would be much, much worse, in other words, if you didn't have cerebrospinal fluid. They would be deadly, and you would get very injured without even playing football, just in your daily living, if you didn't have the cerebrospinal fluid. Well, that cerebrospinal fluid is produced by and secreted from ependymal cells, which are neuroglia. All right, those are the yellow ones. You also have microglia, shown in the lower right. Microglia are macrophages. Macrophages are cells that specialize in phagocytosis. They're called macrophages because they tend to phagocytize large chunks of stuff. So there are all kinds of macrophages that are important to your immunity, for instance, that are not part of the nervous system, but microglia are the macrophages of the nervous system. And so they there's a hell of a lot of these things surveilling your brain and spinal cord all the time, getting rid of debris that should not be there and that could hurt you. Whether it's worn out stuff or invading microorganisms, whatever, the microglia are on the job. And then oligodendrocytes, which you see above that, are cells of the central nervous system that form myelin sheaths around myelinated axons of the central nervous system. Now, I said a while ago that certain axons are myelinated and certain ones aren't. Myelinated axons, because of the appearance of myelin, are whitish, and therefore that's what we call white matter. In the brain we have gray matter and white matter. That you've probably heard of. White matter is the myelinated axons that are in that central nervous system. And what makes the myelin sheaths are neuroglia in the central nervous system, are neuroglia called oligodendrocytes. Now, what does oligo mean? Anyone? What's an oligarch or an oligarchy? What does arc mean? What is a monarch? Right, arc means rule. Monarch is a single ruler. An oligarchy is a state that's ruled by just a few people instead of just one. So oligo means multiple but not many. It's somewhere between mono and poly. Dendro means tree-like branch.
So oligodendrocytes are so named because they have a few major branches to them. The main part of the cell is where it's actually indicated on this slide. But notice there's some small number of branches that are coming off that cell. And that's why it's called an oligodendrocyte. So a single oligodendrocyte, which is a glial cell, wraps portions of itself several times around a little section of axon for several different axons, several different neurons. All right? So there are multiple neurons involved, but each neuron has just a little bit of segment of its axon wrapped in myelin from that one oligodendrocyte. And that same oligodendrocyte does the same thing for a little piece of axon on several other neurons. So for all of those axons to be fully myelinated, it would take many oligodendrocytes, is what I'm saying. Does that make sense? So a myelin sheath is really just a wrapped up, but what would otherwise be a flat sheet of the cell, plasma membrane and plasma membrane without very much, almost no cytoplasm in between, right? You have the cell and plasma membrane comes out into a flat sheet, and then that flat sheet gets wrapped around several times around a part of an axon. That's what forms a myelin sheath. And so in the central nervous system, a single cell contributes to a myelin sheaths of multiple different neurons, but that's different from how it happens in the peripheral nervous system. So all four of these types that we just talked about, these are found only in the central nervous system. Okay, that's not all the neuroglia though. We also have, in slide 8 now, what are called Schwann cells, named after Schwann, of course. So Schwann cells is an eponym, a word that's named after a person, which unfortunately biology is full of, but I say unfortunately because it doesn't really tell you anything about it. It's just honoring someone who found it or was important somehow in elucidating it. So Schwann cells is still in use, but Schwann cells have another name, which is called neurolemmocyte. Those are two interchangeable words. You can call them either one. And so a neurolemmocyte is also neuroglial, but it's a neuroglial cell of the peripheral nervous system. And it does the same... Yeah, go ahead.
So astrocytes are not in the peripheral nervous system?
No. All the four in the previous slide were central nervous system. Did I say peripheral?
Yeah.
Oh, you have to listen to what I'm thinking, not what I'm saying. Sorry about that. Yeah, those four that were all in that one slide, those were all central nervous system. And that's why, as I said, astrocytes contribute to the formation of the blood-brain barrier. That would be central nervous system, right? Good catch, though. Okay, so Schwann cells or neurolemmocytes do the same thing that an oligodendrocyte does in the central nervous system, only the Schwann cell is doing it in the peripheral nervous system, and it does it just a little bit differently. Remember, a single oligodendrocyte had multiple arms, and so it was forming multiple myelin sheaths on parts of several different central nervous system axons. A neurolemmocyte forms a single myelin sheath around part of just one peripheral nervous system axon. And that's most of the time. Actually, there are two types of neurolemmocytes. Those that form myelin sheaths and those that do not. At the top, we're looking at the formation of a myelin sheath. So the Schwann cell or neurolemmocyte has, you know, if it were unrolled, it would be like toilet paper, basically. And that toilet paper gets wrapped around many times, just like it's wrapped many times around the cardboard core of a toilet paper.
The cardboard core would represent the little piece of axon of the neuron itself, but the toilet paper would represent the myelin sheath. And that all collectively in that one place is one neurolemmocyte. And the next little myelin sheath on that same axon is a totally different neurolemmocyte. All right? So those are the Schwann cells or neurolemmocytes that actually form myelin sheaths. But in the bottom, what we're doing is comparing it to an oligodendrocyte. There, I thought I had a picture of the other kind, though. Let me see what's... Yeah, on slide 9, you have a picture of the other kind of Schwann cell. This is not a myelinated axon, even though this axon is surrounded by a Schwann cell. And that's because the Schwann cell is not wrapping many times around the cell. That's the way it electrically insulates it. Here it's just surrounding it, as neuroglia in general do. Neurons basically are surrounded by neuroglia of various types to keep neurons from directly touching other neurons, except where they're supposed to touch, like at synapses. Everywhere else, you're going to have some sort of neuroglia or another separating that neuron from other neurons. And so that's what's happening here with this type of Schwann cell. It's not actually myelinating this axon, but it is covering it. By the way, the big deal about myelination, and we'll discuss how this happens later, is that if an axon is myelinated, its speed of propagation of an action potential, how fast that action potential travels down the length of the axon, is greatly increased compared to one that's not myelinated. And so there are some axons that are a lot faster than other axons in terms of the flow of information from the cell body to the axon terminal. Those are the myelinated ones. Okay, that's enough about 9. Let's now go to 10 and start talking more about physiology. This was mostly anatomy so far. We're looking at a little piece of plasma membrane here. And embedded in that plasma membrane are two proteins, the orange and the cyan one. Two membrane-bound proteins that are acting as ion channels. So we talked about ion channels before. Ion channels are necessary in a plasma membrane if you want to get ions through the membrane. And why is that? In other words, why don't the ions just go right through the phospholipid bilayer? Because they're charged. They're fully charged. That's by definition what an ion is, right? An ion has a mismatch between the number of electrons and the number of protons compared to a neutral atom. Neutral atom doesn't have any charge because the number of negative electrons equals the number of positive protons. But in an ion, either electrons have been removed or electrons have been added, and therefore the number of negatives does not equal the number of positives, and the ion is either positively charged or negatively charged. What do we call a positively charged ion? A cation. And we call a negatively charged ion an anion. Okay, so these are fully charged. That means they're beyond polar. A polar molecule is not charged, but it has a partial charge to it somewhere. And remember that phospholipids themselves are amphipathic, meaning that there's part of that molecule that's charged and part that isn't, or part that's polar and part that isn't, another part that's nonpolar. What are the nonpolar parts of a phospholipid? What parts? I don't understand this hand dance. What are they called? I call them tails.
Okay.
The phospholipid tails are the nonpolar parts of those amphipathic molecules. And nonpolar means what with respect to interaction with water? What's the corresponding word? hydrophobic. Right, the tails are hydrophobic. They therefore prefer, in a sense, if you allow me to anthropomorphize them, to avoid water. The head, on the other hand, the globular head to which the tails are connected, is the polar part. And we've already talked about why the phospholipid bilayer spontaneously forms. It's the only way, really, that the tails can be around other tails, which they don't mind being, and away from water on either the outside or the inside. Whereas each of the hydrophilic polar heads are right next to water, either the exterior or the interior water, which they don't mind. So even though an ion is a small particle that would otherwise be able to slip through the phospholipid bilayer, it's that charge that prevents that. Now, there is some leakage, of course. It's not a perfect seal. But ions don't readily go right through the phospholipid bilayer, and therefore, if you need to move a bunch of them in a short amount of time through that membrane, you have to have facilitated diffusion, right? Well, you'll only have facilitated diffusion if there's a gradient, of course. Otherwise, if you need to move an ion and there isn't a gradient, it would have to be pumped. There would have to be active transport accomplishing that. But we always do have gradients with respect to these two important ions shown here, sodium and potassium. Gradients are always in place, not just for neurons, for all cells of the body. It's always true that the sodium ion concentration in the extracellular fluid is much higher than it is for the intracellular fluid. And it's always true, the reverse is always true for potassium ions. Potassium ion concentration intracellularly is always higher than the concentration extracellularly. So both of these particles separately, independently, both of them have their own gradient. There is a sodium ion gradient, and it has nothing to do with the potassium ion gradient. All right? A gradient depends only on that type of particle. So what is it, why is it that these gradients are in place to begin with? Why is it that there is a concentration gradient for each of these two ions? No, diffusion can never create a gradient. It can only destroy a gradient. Right, if you have a gradient, a gravitational gradient of water, water wants to spill down the hill, right? If you allow that to happen, you're only going to make the gradient less. You're never going to create the gradient because you can try as many times as you want. The water's not going to move uphill and stockpile itself. So why is it that we have these gradients of ions? Well, what else? What other kind of proteins are embedded in this membrane that you know about and that we've discussed? Or let me ask another question. In general, what sorts of things do you have to have to create a gradient? They are proteins, but so are these. What kind of proteins? A gated protein is only going to allow or disallow diffusion. What I'm talking about is how is it that you stockpile sodiums on the outside and stockpile potassiums on the inside to begin with? Pumps are responsible for creating gradients. If you need to move something from where there is not very much of it already to somewhere where there's already a lot of it, that's moving it in the direction opposite from what it wants to diffuse, right? You're stockpiling it. That is an active process. Diffusion is always passive. The opposite is always active. And so you have pumps that are responsible. What are those pumps? The sodium-potassium exchange pumps, exactly.
Those ones that I said are responsible for about 40% of your food budget, because they occur in all of your cells, not just these neurons. Those are always busy spending ATP to pump sodium ions out of the cell and simultaneously pump potassium ions into the cell. And if they were ever to stop working, then these gradients would dissipate. They would come to zero. If there is no gradient, then there is no tendency for diffusion to occur if there happens to be a channel for them to diffuse through. Right? You have to remember, you have two important requirements for diffusion to take place. There has to be a gradient. And what's the second? There has to be a way for that particle to get from A to B, from one place to the other. Right. Well, you have the gradients always because you continuously have sodium-potassium exchange pumps, which are not shown here, working. That's what establishes and maintains the gradients. Normally, you don't have the ability, though, to get from A to B. Sodium doesn't have the ability to go from outside to inside, which is how where it wants to go, because it's an ion and therefore doesn't easily go through the phospholipid bilayer. Same for potassium, except it wants to go out, and it normally can't. So even though there is a gradient for both of them, there isn't a way for them to diffuse so that they normally don't. What we're looking at in this picture is a way for them to actually diffuse through ion channels. And any given ion channel is usually a very specific ion channel, meaning that not just any ion can go through that channel, but a specific type of ion. That's why there are specific sodium ion channels and specific potassium ion channels. All right? But a channel can never be used as a pump, as we discussed what seems like a long time ago now. Because a channel, when it is open, and it's not necessarily always open, but when a channel is open, that's only going to allow for downward diffusion, right? Down its gradient is what I mean here, not down in the picture. If you open up a hole, all you're going to do is allow things to diffuse. They're not going to volunteer to be stockpiled. So the pumps are not channels. They're proteins in the membrane as well, but the pumps are active transporters that are what other kind of transporter besides a channel? Remember the different kinds of transport proteins? Channels and what else? No, receptors aren't necessarily even transport proteins. Some are, like the ones we've discussed so far, but not all of them are even transporters. That's a process. The other kind besides channels are carrier proteins, remember. A carrier protein latches on to a particle temporarily, and when the protein changes shape, that carries it to the other side of the membrane. Now, it could carry it down its gradient, so that would still be diffusion. It wouldn't require any other expenditure of energy. But all pumps have to be carrier proteins, because in order to stockpile them, you have to actively grab onto them and force them in the direction opposite to that in which they want to diffuse, and then let go of them on the other side. That's how the sodium-potassium exchange pump operates. We don't see that working here, but that's responsible for maintaining, establishing first and maintaining each of these two gradients. All right, so what happens if these, either one of these things is opened as a channel? Well, if a sodium ion channel opens up, and there's multiple ways in which that can occur because there's multiple different kinds of sodium ion channels. But whatever it is that opens it up, if it does open up, there's one thing that's going to occur, and that is the influx of sodium ions because of the gradient. And that's the only reason. The gradient is such that the sodium is always going to come in simply because the inside has a lower concentration of sodium. Diffusion happens from high concentration to low concentration. But what matters to the operation of a neuron is not that it's really sodium. The important thing is that sodium is a cation. It's positively charged,
And therefore, every time a sodium ion travels into the cell from the extracellular fluid, what you're doing is moving a positive charge to the inside of the cell. Now, these membrane potentials that I've been talking about, those are measured, you know, if you use two electrodes to measure them, you put one electrode just outside the membrane and the other electrode just inside the membrane at the same position. The voltage would be any charge difference between those two points. And that's what I mean by across the membrane, through or across the membrane. So you have a voltage all the time called the resting membrane potential. But if a sodium ion channel gets opened up, now you have positives that are coming into the cell. And so that electrode at the interior face of this membrane, that region is going to have a more positive value, right? Because positives are coming in. Well, what I think I explicitly said in the previous chapter when we were talking about neuromuscular junctions or action potentials in neurons and myofibers is that at rest, a cell has a membrane potential that is negative inside. The resting membrane potential is a negative voltage because the interface of the membrane is negative compared to the outside. So a positive coming in is going to make it less negative. It's going to make it more go up towards zero because you're adding positive to a negative number. All right? On the other hand, if a potassium ion channel opens up, now all of a sudden, because of its gradient, which is in the opposite direction, you're taking positives away because potassium ions are also cations. A positive being removed from the inner surface is going to make that inner surface less positive or more negative. That makes sense? So these two fluxes of these ions, both of which are positive, since they're occurring in opposite directions, have opposite effects on the plasma membrane potential. And what's going to happen with sodium ion coming in, if a sodium ion channel opens up, is if you think of it as a graph of voltage versus time, it's level at first, that's the resting membrane potential, which is somewhere below zero. An influx of sodium ions is going to cause that voltage to rise. On the other hand, an efflux or movement outward of potassium ions when you open up the potassium ion channel is going to cause it to go down in the graph. It's going to become less positive, more negative. Now, those are two really important things to always have in mind when we are going to continue talking about how this operates in terms of action potentials. We'll stop there, though.